This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Welcome to London, where we have a packed house here for Does Islam Need Reformation? This evening's debate. Thanks very much to iEra for continuing this important series, which allows avenues of discussion to be shared with a wide audience. Tonight we'll be talking about Does Islam Need Reformation? Never have so many Muslims lived in lands that are not Islamic. How is that going to look? What is that going to mean? How is it going to work? Are new fatwas, new laws, new understandings needed within our community in order to make this work? And what about the people of the lands where Muslims are now living? How is this interaction going to go forward? Daesh, meanwhile, claims a caliphate. Is this something that all Muslims should accept and do accept? If not, what does that schism mean? All of these are areas we'll be looking at tonight and more. I'd like to take a moment now to introduce this evening's panelists, beginning over on my left with Tom Holland. Tom Holland is a historian of antiquity and the early Middle Ages. He's author of Rubicon, Persian Fire and Millennium, and the translator for Penguin Classics of Herodotus Histories, and about to do a Penguin Classic on one of the first ever English royal, right? There we go.
First King of England.
Very exciting, we look forward to that. His most recent book, Dynasty, The Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar, was published last September in 2015. His previous book, In the Shadow of the Sword, covered late antiquity and the emergence of Islam. Meanwhile, Islam, The Untold Story, was his award-winning documentary, questioning received Muslim traditions about the life of Prophet Muhammad. Please welcome Tom Holland. To my right, welcome Zahra Huda Faris. Zahra is a speaker and researcher at the Muslim Debate Initiative. Zahra Faris is a graduate of Arabic and Islamic Studies from SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies. She has delivered lectures at a number of universities around the world, including King's College London and University College London. She has publicly debated Green Party leader Natalie Bennett. And Zahra speaks on a plethora of topics, including women in Islam, justice for women and men, Reformation and Revival, Muslims in the West, and more. She most recently sat on the motion, This House Believes Sharia Law is Fairer Than English Law. Please welcome Zahra Faris. To my left again, Theo Hobson is a journalist and theologian. Theo Hobson is an Anglican theologian. He was educated at St. Paul's School in London. He read English literature at the University of York, then theology at the University of Cambridge, where he was a member of Hughes Hall. Theo has written on Protestant thought, especially its relationship with secular liberalism, and currently writes a blog on The Spectator. Welcome, please, Theo Hobson. To my right, Abdullah Al-Andalusi, debater, thinker, and co-founder of the Muslim Debate Initiative. Abdullah Al-Andalusi is an international speaker, thinker, and Muslim activist. His work involves explaining and demonstrating, by rational argument, the intellectual proofs for the Islamic belief system and promoting the Islamic way of life and solutions for contemporary problems. Abdullah has also spoken at numerous universities, colleges, and regularly appears on various TV channels, including BBC and Al Jazeera. In 2009, Abdullah co-founded the public discussion forum, the Muslim Debate Initiative. Please welcome Abdullah. Next to Abdul on my right is Safrukh Chowdhury. He's a theologian and academic. Safrukh Chowdhury completed his undergraduate studies in philosophy in 2002, focusing on medieval philosophical theology at King's College London, before embarking on further studies in Arabic and traditional Islamic sciences at Al-Azhar University in Cairo, Egypt. He returned to London to complete his master's degree in Islamic studies with distinction. Safrukh has taught philosophy and Islamic studies at both undergraduate and postgraduate level. He is an independent writer and teacher in critical thinking, history, and religious studies. Please welcome Safrukh. Finally, on my left, Dr. Taj Hagi is a Muslim educator from the Muslim Educational Centre of Oxford. Dr. Taj is an Oxford-trained historian and theologian who is a specialist in Islam, the Middle East, and Africa. Apart from his scholarly expertise in Quranic, hermeneutics. How do you say that?
Hermeneutics.
Okay. I shouldn't have revealed my ignorance there. Islamic theology, Middle East history, and African politics. Dr. Hagi has brought his liberal views to the place of his birth and established South Africa's first inclusive house of Muslim worship. And that is our panel this evening. Now, before we get started, I want to introduce some general rules for all of my speakers and you as an audience. This is going to be a well-mannered but interesting and possibly exciting debate. There is no need for bad language and it won't be accepted. I am the chair here this evening and I will bring out my inner Miss Trunchbull if I have to. Those who read children's literature know what I mean. You'll be locked in the closet. So let's have some good behaviour, some enthusiastic responses. And if anybody does fall into any form of hate speech, a threatening manner, or any form of unpleasantness, we have external security and you will be asked to leave. That won't apply to my wonderful panel, who will be delightful. However, please do observe some timings. If I feel you've gone off topic, I will reserve the right to rein everybody in order that you all get a fair share and that the audience benefits. If I have to warn you twice, if I feel you're not listening to me, then I will cut into your discourse and may be not be keen to come back to you, and again, you'll miss out. So without further ado, tonight is going to be done in a question time manner. So we will begin with a question from our audience. Mahmoud Khan.
Hello, good evening.
Welcome.
My question is for Safrukh Chowdhury. Is the whole debate around Islam and Reformation really about theology, or is it more to do with politics? Thank you.
I want to thank my co-panelists, audience, thank you, good evening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, I guess some people do look at the Reformation debate primarily through theology. So there are some aspects of Islamic theology that are seen as problematic. Just to give you a couple, the idea of martyrdom, for example, that came up. Sam Harris has been sort of bashing that idea around quite a bit. That, you know, this idea of dying for a higher plane or something like that, or a higher ideal, that's dangerous. Another sort of theological idea that's come under attack, and I'm sure other theological precepts will be brought out in the discussion and the debate tonight. But another one is the fact that the Quran, the text of the Quran is taken as the, you know, the absolute literal word of God, whereas that's dangerous because that locks us into absolutes, that makes it an immovable text, things like that. So for some people, yeah, I mean, these ideas, if they should be reformed. Excuse me, these ideas should be reformed. However, I think there is a strong case for the driver for, or the clamour for reforming Islam being political. So some reasons could be, political reasons could be, the fact that in Europe, for example, there is a strong visibility of Islam. There's a growth of Islam in the public space. So you've got Islamic services, Islamic products. You know, you've got this idea of creeping Sharia that the media, the tabloids like to use. You know, you've got Islamic symbols, so the headscarf, the veil in some cases, minarets. So what we're starting to, you know, we're starting to see more and more an encroachment of Islam into the public space. So that could be a possible reason, because that's an indicator, that's a marker that really secularism isn't something Muslims have wholeheartedly embraced, because the pre-modern understanding of Islam anyway is that Islam is totalizing. In other words, Islam regulates every aspect of life. So that could be one possible reason. Another possible reason could be the demographic explosion. You know, Muslim growth rate is very, very, very high. And so what was once a small problematic minority is now going to become a large problematic minority, if I can say that, if I can put it like that. So the Muslim percentage is growing. The failure of integration policy or assimilation models. So in Europe, there is it is clear that governments are struggling to co-opt Muslims into adopting secular values. Muslims have been sort of putting it at arm's length. They've not embraced it. They've not been convinced of embracing a secular ideal. Just to summarise, some people look at it as theology, but primarily I think it's more political. The driver for reforming Islam has been political, some of the reasons I mentioned.
Thank you. Tom, can I bring you in here? Some of what we were hearing there from Safrouk, an encroachment of Islam on public space threatens secularism of Europe. Does that mean Islam has to change, Europe has to change? Is there a happy medium?
Well, I think lurking in the question is the implicit sense that actually European Islam has already changed, because another way of phrasing that division between theology and politics would be to say church and state. Now, I understand why you didn't say church or state, because obviously the concept is a Christian one. But I think the fact that you see this division now as existing is interesting for the way in which it suggests that Christian concepts are starting to seep into the intellectual fabric of European Islam. Now, that division of church and state within Christendom reaches a long way back. I mean, it has its origins ultimately in the response of Jesus to the question when he got given the coin, should we pay tribute to Caesar? Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, render unto God what is God's. And that kind of enshrined a notion that the political and the spiritual should be distinct, which has fed into modern-day secularism. If you like, secularism is a Christian invention that has been secularized. And I think the implication of your question is that the same process is now starting to happen to Islam, that Muslims are starting, in Europe certainly, are starting to internalize this notion that there is indeed a division between the sacral and the secular. And the fact that you frame it in that way, I think, sort of serves to answer your question. I think that we can see that. Can you just what specifically was the question? The actual phrasing.
The debate being really about theology, or was it a political debate in regards to Islam and Reformation?
In which case, it's about both. And we have two different categories there, and that is extremely interesting.
Why do you see Muslims as internalising this division between mosque and state, if you want to put it in that way? What do you see the markers as being Muslims internalising it or conceptualising it in that way?
I'm going to hold you there, because I actually want to bring in Abdullah on this, and we'll come back to you in a second. Abdullah, this idea of church and state seeping into the Muslim community here in Europe, is that something you recognise?
I think the problem in the West is it demands all its minorities to assimilate into the state ideology, and it has always done so for other minorities, Jews and Catholics prior to that, and we're just the latest minority of which we have a belief system which has something to say about the political realm, or in essence, man's affairs or life's affairs. We believe that your purpose in life has a connection to life's affairs, a very radical idea. But that was actually the idea of every civilization up until the Western civilization realized they had a problem with trying to reconcile issues with their religion. What I would disagree with Tom Holland was, or maybe on a point of text, is that when Jesus was asked, according to New Testament anyway, should we pay taxes to Rome? And Jesus says, why are you trying to trap me? Because he knows that any way he answers, and generally the Jews at the time didn't like paying taxes to Rome. Rome was occupying Judea. And so Jesus had a very clever answer, which is, give unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and give unto God what belongs to God. But what belongs to God? Well, the heavens and the earth. Right? That was Jesus' argument, and people were amazed at the argument, and they couldn't fault him. He could have just said, yeah, pay taxes. Why didn't you say that? Why don't you just be more direct then, if that's what he meant? Right? But what we find is later on, an individual called St. Paul, who I would say is the first reformist of Christianity, did away with the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law, the Law of Moses, was a complete way of life. It was a political, it gave political laws, it gave a system of ruling. And St. Paul did away with that, made Christianity more acceptable to Gentiles, to Greeks, to Romans. And when in Rome, do as the Romans, this is probably St. Paul's philosophy. And that created the problem within Christianity, because St. Paul never envisioned Christians getting power. They believed that Jesus was going to come in their lifetime. So who needs to care about power? When Jesus comes, he will be the one in power and he will set everything right. But Jesus didn't turn up in their lifetime. And a couple hundred years later, Christians ended up in power and they didn't know what to do when they got into power. And that kind of led to the kind of problems and also the rise of the Roman Catholic Church and so on and so forth. So anyway, before I go off the topic, what I'll just say is that the question isn't really do Muslims have to change Islam, or should we reform Islam to fit into the West? The real question, which was asked by scholar Tim Winter on the matter, was can Western liberalism tolerate Islam? And I think that's a better question to ask.
That's a great one that we'll be coming back to in a second. Fia, I'm going to let you have a question asked, and then you can bring in some of your thoughts on that, because this question is for you.
I'll ask that question.
Go on then. Go ahead.
I think we're getting to some pretty heavy stuff here, which is my sort of area, which is great. I agree that Christianity begins with this separation of church and state, basically. Whether you say it's through Jesus, or I agree it's largely through Paul, actually, where he says that the Christian community accepts living within a non-Christian political order, which is the Roman Empire. And they're not even planning to take over the Roman Empire and Christianize it, at least in the New Testament period. They're assuming that their religion is non-political. And now that's a complete difference, as you all know, from the origins of Islam, where the two things come together, where the prophet is, in a sense, launching a new political order. One historian says he's his own Constantine, who's the Roman emperor later on. So in a sense, it's true that when Christianity does start having power, it doesn't know what to do with it, although it does have a few hundred years to sort of get used to the idea. It doesn't suddenly panic and go, hey, help, we're having power now. But that's quite a good way of setting up the difference, is that Christianity is not a religion which assumes that religion and politics are a unity. And you can call that by different reasons. Later on, it's called Christendom, or a slightly contentious term, theocracy. The unity of religion and politics. Christianity is uniquely skeptical about that, and that's its big difference from Islam.
I think I just want to bring in here the machinations of the Catholic Church and the politics of the bishopric.
Yeah. Well, in practice, of course, Christianity does become an empire and have power. So in a sense, it does resemble Islam or any other form of empire or whatever, where it's a Christian power. and it was the most powerful in the world. But the difference is that when you look at its founding texts, there isn't a basis for that unity of religion and politics. That's the big difference. Although in practice, it does become a political power.
Could I just...
Go ahead.
I think it's distinctively Western, actually. It's a Latin notion. And this idea that church and state should be separate, actually, you don't get it, for instance, in Byzantium to nearly the same degree. It really gets enshrined in European history in the 11th century with a remarkable pope called Gregory VII, who absorbs within the Catholic Church the right, the sacral right that emperors and kings within Christendom had traditionally laid claim to. And by doing that, he effectively desacralized the realm of the king, the realm of what would become known as the secular. And so the corollary of that ultimately was that by absorbing the sacral into itself, the Catholic Church created a space which people both within and outside the church were able to accept existed beyond the sacral level.
And
it's that
it's
that that ultimately feeds into European Western modernity, because you have this concept of church and state as being separate entities. But the irony of it is that the godfather of that separation is actually a pope.
Let's have the next question, which I think should link quite nicely onto that. David Knowles in the audience. David Knowles. Welcome, and your question is for Tom.
It's for Tom Holland, and I was to ask, when we think of the word Reformation, another idea comes to mind, that of Puritanism. To what extent do you think the current strain of militant Islam stands in the same puritanical Adventist tradition as, say, the English Puritans who cancelled Christmas?
And you want me to hold the limelight by answering that?
I think,
question?
How can we... Let's just begin to touch on this word Reformation,
okay,
shall we? And I'll bring everybody
okay,
in.
Okay, I'll try and keep it brief, although this is a massive topic, obviously. I think, obviously, there is a risk that people from Christian backgrounds run when they talk about other religions, and particularly Islam, that they assume that Christianity is normative and that religions sort of follow a life cycle like a butterfly. And you think, you know, for God's sake, it's time for a reformation now. That clearly is not the case. Islam, like Christianity, evolves according to its own rhythms, its own DNA. Now, having said that, I do think that there are points of resemblance between the Protestant Reformation and what is happening within Islam. And there are several reasons why I think it's legitimate to say that. The first is that both Christianity and Islam are founded on moments that exist within history. And so, therefore, both within Christianity and within Islam, the notion that the lifetime of Jesus, the lifetime of Muhammad, has a particular sacral potency, it is particularly instructive for those who follow, is enshrined. And so a tendency to look back to the example of the apostles, if you're Christian, to the Salafs, if you are Muslim, is always been a part of it and has obtained an increased saliency, obviously, with Salafism. The very name suggests that. Now, I think that there is a particular parallel between what happened in the 16th century with Christianity and what is happening now in the form of the print of in the form of the internet. Because what happened in the 16th century was that the printing press made available scripture translated into vernacular languages that hitherto had not been as readily accessible. And it enabled tinkers and tailors, to the horror of people like Thomas More, to read these texts and to arrive at conclusions themselves that were conditioned of their own conscience, bred of their own conscience, not mediated by the traditions of the church. I think that the internet is playing a very similar role in the development of Islam, because what is happening is that anyone can now go online and find Quranic scripture, hadiths, life of Muhammad, whatever.
I'm going to rein you in a bit there because I think we're going to move into a new area slightly.
The internet is the printing press of the Islamic Reformation.
OK, Okay, very good. We'll come back to that. I just want to bring in Dr. Taj, because there was a word there that sprang out from David's question, Puritanism. And Tom was to summarise, are we romanticising the past and its heroes somehow? And even the passing of Puritanism, is that something that is a current trend, with Daesh? Would you like to address that word, Puritanism?
Yeah, clearly, I think, and many people think that the utopian society of 7th century desert Arabia is the one for all times. That was a peculiar moment in history. Islam is not wedded to a culture or to a region. To me, Islam is universal and timeless, particularly the Quran. And so for us to talk about the Reformation in terms of what happened in Western Europe, that trajectory is not quite what Islam has undergone. I think for me, when I was invited to come to this gathering, the idea wasn't, does Islam need a reformation? For me, it was always, does Islam have, Islam actually needs a restoration, meaning that we need to go back to the original, to the pristine, to the text of Islam. Unfortunately, today we have a situation in the world, and especially in Europe, you know, where the idea that we are Muslim without any rationality, and I think we are essentially ritualistic Muslim. We are not really thinking Muslim. We think that emblems, superficial symbols, and I may offend some people here, things like, you know, the long beard, things of hair covering, or facial masking, things of that nature, that's Islam. I would say with the utmost respect to my brothers and sisters who do that, that's not Islam, that's just a cultural manifestation. We need to get back not to the puritanical Islam, but to the Islam of the Quran. Now, what has happened in 1400 years, and that's part of the reason why the earlier question talked about, is this thing a theological question or political question? Now, I would respectfully disagree with my colleague at the far end. I think it's essentially theological. Because what has happened in 1400 years is that, you know, Islam has actually moved further and further from the original ethos. Now, as a Muslim or any other Muslim would agree that there's only one divine text. There's no other divine text with all the respect I can muster. It's only the Quran is the divine text. Everything else, and I call it the toxic trio or the terrible triplets. The terrible triplets are the Hadith, number one. Number two, the Sharia. Number three, the fatwas. Now, if you look at all those three, these are essentially masculine devised interpretations, commentary, and opinions. They can never have the force or the legitimacy of law. And so we have a situation today in Islam where we no longer follow the text, but we follow these secondary, supplementary, ancillary literature that often contradicts the divine text.
I love that point, and I think we're going to explore it more about the Hadith in a little while, so I'm just going to stop you there. Thank you. I just want to come to Zara and take up a point that you raised. Zara, do Muslims in the UK recognise in your experience a need to change themselves or their sacred text in order to live here? If so, why?
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, greetings, assalamu alaikum, and thank you to the organisers for inviting me and to everybody for coming here this evening and taking time out of your evening. Now, the title, Does Islam Need a Reformation? And whether this is a question that is present in the minds of Muslims here in the UK, I think it's not a question that Muslims feel themselves, but rather they feel that this is a question that is constantly being asked of them, and one that has been asked for a very long time, in fact. And the question has never really been, I would say, about whether Islam itself needs an ideological or a theological reformation, but rather the question is Islam or secular liberalism? Should Islam simply just adopt a version of secular liberalism. And I think that is the question a lot of people are actually dealing with, rather than the mechanics of a reformation and what the church or the Christian experience was. And one of the most frequented footholds, I would say, in this discussion, and perhaps has been touched upon by my co-panelist, Dr. Hagi, just now, is the issue of women and the liberation of women and these emblematic issues and the apparently male-dominated scholarship. And I would just point out that I would contest that, and many people would contest that Islamic scholarship has been male-dominated. There are works, for example, by a scholar called Sheikh Akram Nadwi that documents at least 8,000 female scholars who were very active and present during the time that all of these laws and provisions were being formulated. So I think there's something to be said there. But moving on to try to stick to the topic itself, in colonial Egypt, for example, this project of trying to force a reformation, I would say, started with British colonial officials specifically citing things like the veil and the treatment of women under Islam as their justification for colonialism. The Bush administration similarly cited wanting to liberate women as their key interest in the lead up to the war. So this is, again, not something new. The thing is, the West began its colonization around the world, particularly the Muslim world. And when I say colonization in this sense, I mean trying to force this secular liberal ideology before it itself had even implemented any idea of modern women's rights, which I find is quite ironic. And in the Muslim world, they took away many of the things that Muslims were enjoying, which if you saw Muslims enjoying those rights, Muslim women enjoying those rights, you wouldn't say they were in need of a reformation.
Well, what sort of rights?
So, for example, in Egypt, there was a very common tradition of Muslim women to train and become doctors, because it's never been considered that women should not study or not be professions or not pursue these sorts of fields. It's never been considered that they should be confined to particular spheres like the household, which is what you see now. However, when Lord Cromer entered Egypt, they basically instituted provisions saying that women need not study to become doctors, saying that our women at home make do with male doctors so you can do the same, which is a huge setback. This is just one example. There are many others. And I just want to add one more thing to this. Okay, let's say that they've been trying to pull the Muslims to this secular liberal worldview. What is it that they are trying to liberate Muslim women to? And I just want to very quickly, if I may, just set out a few of the fruits.
I wouldn't say a few.
Okay.
One or two, maybe.
Okay, so for example, shocking domestic violence statistics, rising divorce, the reduction of marriage to little more than a piece of paper, the sexual objectification of both men and women for commercial purposes, education gaps, criminal punishment gaps, the ongoing isolation and discrimination between the genders in this country, and not just this country, but, you know, secular liberal countries generally. So I would ask, is this what is being offered? Is this what we are trying to be reformed to? I would argue that Muslims need to revive what their classical understanding of Islam was, revive the proper practice of Islam as it was practiced and which flourished for hundreds of years. And that is what needs to be done. This question of reformation or pulling the Muslim community towards a secular liberal ideology, the advertisement for it, I'm afraid, is not great.
Thank you, sir. Now, there was actually a gentleman in the audience who had his hand up at the beginning of your answer. Would you like to ask a question? You're welcome.
Yes, please. Hi, good evening, guys. Thank you very much. This one of the senses that I get from the debate is that the sense in which we're using the word reformation... One of the senses that I get from the debate is that the way that reformation has been used has been to use some kind of historical model. So, you know, it's got to be a Christian model, and if we use this kind of historical model, can there be a reformation of Islam? But what I'd be more interested to know from the panel is whether or not reformation could work with new thoughts, with new hermeneutical, you know, resources, with new approaches. And, you know, it's not the case that we have to reform Islam, some kind of historical reformation, but maybe Islam could be reformed using new methods of reformation, and whether or not that's possible.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you. I'm going to go to two of our panel at least for this. Can we have some kind of agreement on what we mean by reformation and whose reformation are we going to follow? Safrouk, would you like to give that a go?
I think it's now we're starting to open up the debate. I mean, look, if you mean by reforming, changing attitudes, Are you changing Muslim attitudes? I'm all for that. So, for example, many Muslims have become individualistic. So they've dropped or they've discarded a sense of a collective obligation, which Islam, you know, emphasizes over and above individual priority. So that individualism has crept in Muslim attitudes. Another sort of thought that has crept into the Muslim community is profit before the prophet. Yeah. So in other words, this idea that money and maximizing money over and above Sharia ethics and prophetic sort of directives, that has creeped into the Muslim psyche. I would like to see that reformed. A third issue is a sort of a hedonistic ethic. So, you know, the tragic sort of grooming case that was just in the media, I think a couple of days ago, three individuals, you know, were found guilty of grooming. That kind of behavior is not a product of Islam. That's totally antithetical to Islam. That's a product of a hedonistic sexual ethic that, you know, you maximize your pleasure as much as you can. That kind of idea I'd like to see reformed, if we mean by reforming Muslims, you know, changing these kind of attitudes. A last one I would say is this idea of being silent against injustice. So people being bombed, you know, in Syria, you know, even continuing in Palestine, yet Muslims are told to remain silent because they're somehow detached from, you know, a sense of global duty to Muslims elsewhere in the world. To use Professor Cornell's phrase, you know, Muslims are becoming well adjusted to injustice. Now, these kind of ideas I would love to reform, if we mean by reform, reforming attitudes. But that's not, I think, what the debate is about. The debate is about there is something inherently... Islam is antithetical to modernity. Islam, you know, it has to go through that aggiornamento, that kind of modernization. Yeah. That is what the claim is right. about. So, I want to submit just very, very quickly, Islam doesn't have to conform to modernity, it only has to be modern.
That's it. Okay, thank you. Please.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. I think we're clarifying. I think that's helpful. I think we're clarifying what the debate, what I think the debate is about, or what it should be about. And what I think is this: the debate is, does Islam need a reformation that clarifies its relationship to Western ideology, to secular humanism, if you like, to the ideology of the West? That's the real debate. We can evade it if we want, but that's the real debate that we can talk about or not talk about tonight. And I think, yes, it needs to clarify whether it believes, there's basic choice of whether it believes in a theocratic model of church, of religion and politics together, or whether it believes in freedom, in whether it believes in affirming other points of view as valid. And that means a form of politics in which people who are not Muslims are not inferior. They are valued, and that's what the West does, and it calls it secularism or secular humanism, okay? The question is, should Islam go down that route? Should it say, yes, there's something good there that we acknowledge, that if we do not go down that route, it's dangerous, because the opposite to that route is Daesh.
What do you feel? Do you feel that without a reformation, we're all going to swing towards Daesh in this country? Is that something that you find inherent in...
In this country, no, because we're not a Muslim country.
Okay. Abdullah.
Yeah. Where do I begin with that statement? Okay. All I'll say is this. I don't think... Islam needs a policy on secular liberalism any more than we need a policy on communism or any other ideology that has come out of the West. Why is it that the alternative to secular liberalism is theocracy? There are so many different forms of government. I would say that the Sharia or a caliphate system resembled a nomocracy, which is rule of law, the law being the absolute sovereign, not a bunch of clerics in control. And I could say that if you want to go theocracy, well, we're going to go to the House of Lords, you'll see about 30 or so bishops there who have the ability and right to legislate or have a say about on British legislation. So one could argue that the Queen being the head of the church as well, that Britain is a theocracy, and you don't seem to have any problem with that in a secular liberalism system.
They're not the only ones making the laws.
Okay, well, governor of the church is also the head of state. All right, that's fine. So what we're seeing is let's get our terms correct. I would say that the rise of certain groups in the Middle East, certain groups in the Middle East which have had connections to secular regimes beforehand, like the Baathists, who are now the children of Saddam Hussein, and President Sisi, who uses fatwas to kill his opponents. What we see in the Middle East is the reformed Islam that was created 100 years ago by colonialism. And they said it, that the colonialists, there's many discussions by Lord Cromer, who discussed about reforming Islam, and he opined that a reformed Islam is Islam no more. And they wanted to create a system and a ruling group in the Muslim world who were pragmatists. And they would bend any kind of Islamic institution to rubber stamp any law they want to justify their very secular nationalist authority. And the entire Muslim world is dominated by pragmatism, not actual legislation from a Islamic source. And that's the problem in the Muslim world, that for 100 years we've already had a quote-unquote reformed Islam, and this reformed Islam is in the image of the West. And it has caused so much tragedies.
How is it in the image of the West?
Okay, well, the idea of secular leaders, for example, that's certainly a Western concept. The idea that the nation above religion or above the idea of a spiritual brotherhood, that's very Western. It doesn't come from Islam. And the fact that you should bind religion to pragmatic concerns, the ends justifies the means, or a type of utilitarianism, again, that is a foreign idea. And these were taught to us by our colonial overlords 100 years ago. And if you look at Lord Cromer's book, Modern Egypt, please read it for yourself, or Macaulay of India, read how they've discussed how they're going to change the minds of the natives and make it more Western, and how to change the way politics is conducted. And Lord Cromer said himself that the Western nations would never tolerate there to create a government in these countries they control based on Mohammedan and outdated Oriental ideals. They said they will never tolerate this, and so they created a government in their image by their own admission. Okay. So this is the issue we have to deal with.
Okay, so I will come to you in a second, Tom. Abdullah is saying that there's been this enforced, falsified reformation in several dictatorships across the Middle East, and look how that's worked out. I think we have a question from the audience here. Yes, please. And I really would like everybody in the audience to think about what would it mean, what would it look like, what would you like a reformed Islam to look like in the UK if you think it needs reformation? And of course, if not, why not? So please, I want some more questions on that.
Thank you for that. Theo made a point, and he presented a dichotomy that if it's not secular liberalism, then it's Daesh. And this is exactly what Daesh says. And he has effectively agreed with Daesh. This is the black and white view Daesh presents to the world. If you are not with us, then you are disbelievers. You are secular liberals, or you are simply with the West. This is what we have to fight. This is what we have to oppose, this idea of this bloody dichotomy which was just presented by Theo. Daesh only came about 2 to 3 years ago. We have a civilization called the civilization of Islam. We had tolerance, we had universities, we had libraries, we had Jews, Christians, and Muslims coexisting for centuries under Sharia, under the same law which Theo considers to be the brainchild of Daesh. This is a point I wanted to present, and you can comment on that.
So, Theo, a simplification of your point, Daesh or not Daesh, is that all we have to live by?
I accept the point that there is a danger of oversimplifying that sort of dichotomy, and that in practice there are, of course, different forms of Islam and so on. But I think the really important question is to what extent Islam accepts that there is something good within the ideal of pluralism and so on that the West has. You would say, well, that's also in traditional Islam. Great. Then affirm it in that way. That's fine. But, its obvious form is the contemporary Western form of human rights and secularism. That's the fullest form of that ideal. And I would say that the medieval caliphates that had their virtues did not have a full form of that. You know, there was still lesser rights to people who didn't sign up to Islam. So a full human rights secularism, the question for Islam that I would like us to be debating tonight, rather than evade, is to what extent does it affirm that?
Zara, yes.
Just a very brief point to hopefully tie up the Daesh dichotomy. Just to point out, as far as I'm aware, they were actually former secular Ba'athists. So again, to cite them as some kind of, you know, opposite end of the spectrum of secularism is false. And also, generally, religion is often invoked for legitimacy by all sorts of people. It doesn't mean that they represent the religion in any way. And they shouldn't be used as an example or a reason for why a particular religion, an entire civilization, needs to reform its beliefs. The War on Terror was described as a battle against Satan fought by the Army of God in 2003 by Bush's Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. So, you know, just because someone uses the language of religion doesn't mean that they are representing the religion or that somehow their religion is now requiring a reformation. That's, I just wanted to make something.
Okay, I don't want us to evade this question that Theo is, which is the point of us being here tonight. What is reformation? What does it need? Do the people in this room who are Muslims need to change in order to be in a secular Western environment, Tom? I'll come to you next, Doctor.
Well, I actually think that the influence of the West has been on Islam has been much greater even than Abdullah implied, because I think that it's had a corrosive effect on the autonomy of Islamic thought, which really until, I suppose, the early 19th century had existed without influence from the West. Christianity, Western Christianity and Islam were not greatly interested in each other. And did not greatly come into ideological contact with each other until the 19th century. And then you mentioned the right of Jews and Christians to live under Islamic rule. But of course, as you will know, it was prescribed in the Quran that Jews and Muslims pay for the privilege and that they be subject to discriminatory taxation. And as it evolved over the course of Islamic history, it was agreed that Jews and Christians should feel humiliated when they paid the tax. Now, that tax, the jizya, was removed, licensed out, together with slavery, over the course of the 19th and 20th century, not primarily because this was a movement welling up from within the ideological marrow of Islam, but under the influence of essentially French revolutionary thoughts. And the very idea, the very phrase, universal human rights, implies something that there exists out there, something like natural law. It's out there, it's universal, it's there. It justifies the fact that everyone should be treated in the same way. Now, traditionally, the justification for law in the Muslim tradition is that it comes from God. So essentially,
is that not a natural law?
No, because in the Western tradition, which ultimately derives from Greek philosophy, is this idea that law exists out there beyond the gods.
An independent law of the gods. Okay, there is a hand at the back. There was a hand, a very patient hand at the back. So please, I think it's a sister, stand up.
I wanted to interject about
it. Let's after this, okay.
Good evening. Assalamu alaikum to those people who are Muslim.
Welcome.
I think there is an aspect to this question that we should really be talking about as well. And this aspect of should Islam be reformed? Yes, we were talking about liberalism and liberal secularism, but it's the idea of modernity, which I heard earlier on. It's the idea that modernity is the only way forward and it is the most humane and most just way forward. I mean, when we talk about modernity, we talk about capitalism and we talk about democracy. But are these things really just? Do they really equal humanity and equality? We all know the history of capitalism. It's a bloody history. It's a black, dirty history of slavery, of taking over other people's countries. And any of us that have studied how this came about would ask this. So surely we should be questioning the premise that modernity is what we should be.
I have your question. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to go to, thank you, good question. Dr. Taj, just to summarise, modernisation for the sake of it, is it a good thing when you apply it to a theology? Can we stick to this this point, please?
No, I think modernisation just for the sake of it is not good. But the point is, you know, we are skirting around the issue here. The issue is, you know, a much reviled prime minister, who shall remain nameless, said the policy of his government was education, education, education. I would say the problem here is theology, theology, theology. You know, Muslims do not wish to admit that things have gone bad in our own house. We would love to talk about the stench out there. We ignore the stink here. So, for example, we see how the Quran has been totally sidelined regarding apostasy. Today, you cannot leave your religion and be safe in any Muslim country. In other words, you can join the club of Islam, but you can never leave it. Apostasy come from the hadith, come from the sharia, come from the fatwas. Same thing about, say, Friday prayers. It's compulsory in the Quran. Women been taught, however, from the hadith, that is optional for them. The issue of blasphemy, so it's not a crime in the Quran. It's been manufactured by the mullahs and the clergy. And the list goes on and on and on. We need to understand one thing. When Islam went to Indonesia, 70,000 islands and archipelago there. In 300 years, it becomes a dominant faith. How did it do that? Not with guns and ammunition and a Daesh type of conversion. It becomes the dominant faith and the largest Muslim country today because it adapted and adjusted to Indonesian culture and society. In other words, the first mosque looked like Hindu temples. The Muslims married local women, ate local food, wore local dress. They became integrated into that society and brought along then their identity as Muslims.
So, doctor, let me just ask that in that case, Islam has already reformed itself to fit in with societies beyond the Arabian Peninsula. It's working.
No, it hasn't worked in there. For example, we've come here with our baggage. I mean, you know, for example, the average Muslim here think of himself, I'm a Pakistani Muslim, I'm a Bangladeshi, Saudi, whatever, or my ancestral baggage. We need to be British Muslims. We need an Islam that is British Islam. Now, let me hear me out. I'm not talking about MI5, MI6 Islam. I'm talking about Islam that's rooted in and relevant to this society. In other words, my Islam is different from Saudi Islam or from South African Islam or from Turkish Islam or whatever, or Kazakhstan Islam, because it is Islam that fits this society, the milieu, the ambience, the atmosphere. We need to make an Islam that is at home in this society.
Thank you. Point. Okay, religion. You're on one. Thank you. Well done. Good point. Okay, so I think we're moving onwards now to a section where we're considering, is there such a thing as a British Islam and a European Islam? And I will bring you in, Abdullah, but can we take another question and hopefully it'll be relevant to yourself. I think a sister at the back on the right, my right. So, yes, black hijab. Far back. Yes, sister. Did you have a question? Okay. Well, brother, you know, you can't get your wife to hold your hand up for you. I mean, how does this look? How does that look? Seriously. No, that wasn't what happened, was it?
No. This is a question for Theo, first of all, salam alaikum to everyone else. The question that you asked on when will Islam or the British Muslims or the European Muslims accept that there's some good in the liberalism or the secularism in the Western world, the same question can go back to the Western world. When will the Western world accept that there is good in Islam? Because if the Western world and the democracy was truly free and equal for everyone else, then they would have accepted Islam as it is and not asked it to reform.
I'm just going to bounce it back. So I take from that you think that you're of the standpoint and the belief that Islam is perfect here as it is, and there's no need for reformation to fit in here. The people can live here with Islam as it is.
My personal view is that Islam is perfect is how certain people interpret it and implement it, that it's not, including here or across the world.
Right, thank you, Theo.
I think that the difficulty is for Muslims to yes, as you say, accept that there's something good within the secular ethos, and that's difficult because there's also, I admit, there's also stuff bad in the West. You know, it's not flawless, and I'm a Christian, and you know, it's the West is largely secular, so there's a tension. It doesn't mean that, you know, I think everything's perfect that the West does, but it means that I accept the necessity for a non-Christian order, for a secular humanist order. I would call the ideology of the West secular humanism, but in a way that's, it's not as negative as that sounds to a lot of us, because you can be religious within it, I would argue. And I don't think it's a threat. Some of the Muslim voices tonight have assumed very fixed, in a very fixed way, that is a threat. That's a threat to us. This ideology of secular humanism, secular liberalism, whatever, that's the enemy. We must fight that. We must make sure that we talk against that. I'm saying, well, no, rethink that. It's not your enemy. It's something in, that religions can live within. There's some forms, I admit, where it can be oppressive to all religions, but they're relatively rare. Most forms of Western secular humanism are friendly enough towards religion of all sorts.
Thank you. I'm going to throw that over to Abdullah, actually. A friendly society, friendly secular liberalism, friendly humanism, is that something you recognise at this time?
Well, I think Theo should debate David Cameron and Theresa May on their muscular liberalism and the fact that they can't tolerate people who don't believe in or adopt British values, whatever that means, including adopting a whole host of policies and even wanting new laws to silence dissent. And you want to pick on this, on just England, I can go to France, which was another old, one of the first three liberal democracies, and they're not so tolerant to their minorities either, very specifically religious minorities, and it's not the first time this has happened. But just to really talk about the issue of modernity, what does modernity mean? Really just means the status quo. And the status quo is predominantly dominated by secular liberalism. If you want to talk about what is just more recent, I could argue that democracy is 1,000 years older than Islam. So democracy is 2,500 years old. So Islam is actually more modern than democracy. So if we want to modernize, we should throw away democracy and obviously adopt Islam. Would they agree to that? Probably not. Of course, one could argue, is the West even democratic? The Greeks of Athens wouldn't agree. But that's a different discussion altogether. There's these issues. But I would also point out what was mentioned about adopting pluralism, multiculturalism. Well, please tell me once the West actually adopts that, because already the politicians are saying multiculturalism has failed. If you just mention Sharia arbitration courts, everyone goes crazy.
I'm going to have to rein you in because you're actually looking outwards and we are supposed to be looking at, does Islam need reformation? That's the question. So we can't.
Well, I wanted to link that to the issue of jizya and how non-Muslims are treated under Islam, and because that was
okay,
issues
I think,
that
I think,
should
I
we.
Think that's why that's widening it out. I'm gonna bring you back to this moment. So we've looked at muscular secular liberalism, perhaps not being as free and friendly as Theo proposed. What is the answer then? As the two parallels living together.
I think as the brother pointed out there, maybe there's something the West could learn from us. So in for 1,300 years, Muslims had a type of multiculturalism, which allowed Jews and Christians to have their own law system, and even in some cases their own police forces administering, their own semi-autonomous areas. That was true multiculturalism. We didn't say to them, "You must adopt, caliphate values or Ottoman values, otherwise you don't belong here." We didn't say that to our minorities. And the jizya was a form of citizenship. According to Rousseau, everyone pays jizya to the British government. You're all contract citizens. That's what jizya means. So we're all dhimmis of the British government.
Okay,
and that's what the jizya
you.
Is. That's
thank
all it
you.
Is.
I'm going to take another question. There's a lady here who's been waiting very patiently in row two. Microphone. Thank you.
Thank you. The question was, does Islam need a reformation? And I don't think it's really more addressed to Muslims. It's addressed to people who think Islam needs a reformation. And it suggests to me that they really mean they want to redact bits of the Quran, the bits of the Quran that they don't like. So this question is addressed to the people who think, people in the panel who think Islam needs reformation, and I'd like to ask them which verses of the Quran they would like redacted.
So let's summarise that. Tom, what are the difficult tracts or the difficult understandings which you find inappropriate for a modernist, secular, liberal society?
In just in the Quran or in the Hadiths? Or
just give us just the Quran.
Okay.
Well, I think the jizya verse is as good as any. I do not recognise this happy multicultural paradise that Abdullah has been painting. It was very explicit that Jews and Christians had to be humiliated in the process of paying this tax. And that understanding brought with it a whole array of restrictions that was imposed on Jews and Christians. In the early caliphate, these restrictions were attributed to Umar, and they passed right the way through into the Ottoman period. And I think that in speaking personally, I prefer an order in which everyone is given the same rights and people are not discriminated against on the basis of their religion. And that seems to me something that Muslims in this country should be able to buy into.
Could I just add
Dr. Taj, quickly.
A couple of problematic verses to the question? I mean, the issue of beating your wife. Now, chapter 4, verse 34. Now, the traditional commentary and translation is, yes, Muslim men have the right to beat the woman. But if you analyze the hermeneutics, the commentary, the syntax, the grammar, and so forth, it talks about separating, not beating up your wife. Okay, so that's clearly a way we need to relook at the Quran. Another verse, of course, is the whole issue of jihad, or the context of jihad. Jihad is used in Quran something like about 45 times. And there's a huge distinction between jihad and qital. One is internal or struggle, and the other is fighting. And yet Muslims tend to conflate the two, as if they're one and the same. They conflate the two because it comes from the hadith. In the hadith, you have over 200 hadiths that talks about jihad, meaning fighting and aggressive belligerency. So yes, we need not to redact the Quran, we need to revisit the original and see the Quran in a holistic internal coherency, instead of cherry-picking one verse there and another verse there, and stop trying to fit the Quran into the hadith. That's where the problem is coming from. We're trying to fit the Quran into the hadith written 300 years or so after the death of Muhammad, and we now have these sort of man-made sayings that masquerades as the authentic divine word of the Prophet Muhammad, and there was no video recorder, and there was no any form of authentic recording of his sayings.
And yet
we think that is
the... No, I hold my finger up to you. You don't hold your finger up to me. I'm the chair. Thank you. Right. So let's move on, because I think we're getting a bit muddied here. I'm actually going to go to a question, a specific question, about how change happens in a faith within a different society, within a different time period. Kadir Ahmed, question? Yes, please. Would you like to ask your question?
Hello, evening there. My question is to Theo Hobson. As a liberal Christian theologian, how legitimate is the comparison between the Christian Reformation of the 16th century and the situation of the Muslim world today?
Thank you for that question. It's a very good question, because so much was happening at this Reformation time in the 16th century, and in fact, I would say the 17th century as well, because it's a slow process, this Protestant Reformation, and it begins as you know with Luther going back to the Bible and so on, and And of course, that has echoes of going back to the sources, back to the Quran, as Taj wants, and so on. In a sense, any religion, when it reforms, is always going back to the original and trying to be more true to it and more pristine and so on. But in the Protestant Reformation, something else happens too. And it's a surprising thing that happens. What happens is that they develop a new form of politics, a whole new vision of political order. In a sense, it happens by mistake. First of all, they're talking about how to be true to the Bible and what St. Paul really meant by faith and so on. But something else emerges over about 50 years or more. And that is the idea that you can have a political order in which religious institutions are not in charge. And you can have a new sort of political order in which different sorts of religion is possible. You can disagree with each other. Of course, they didn't all move in this direction. Some of them moved in the other direction and became more tyrannical and Calvinist and so on. But gradually, there was a minority that did move in this totally new direction, which said that God wants you to be free to choose how you do religion. And the state, that exists to protect your freedom to do religion as you want. Totally new idea. No one had ever done that before.
Let me just ask you something. A totally new idea. Who decided God said that they should change?
Politicians and theologians. It was a minority movement.
But how can you decide God says something?
Well, just in the way that we all decide. You argue for it. And that argument prevailed.
But, yes, okay. Zara.
Was it just funny? On the points raised about that were, you know, potentially wanting to be redacted, and one of them was the jizya. And I just want to clarify something and point out that often when we don't understand something, we think we need to get rid of it. And just to explain some things about what the jizya actually was. It was actually a waiver so that non-Muslims wouldn't have to serve militarily. So it removed the obligation on them to serve military duty. It was in order to have actual protection and not actually fight in the way that the Muslims had to. Not only that, but it wasn't obligatory on women or children or on the poor. And if you were poor, you would pay no jizya at all, and you're actually entitled to funds from the state. So it was merely an exemption that was instituted for people because they were not expected to serve up their lives in order to protect the state. They were considered people who the state themselves had to protect. And by way of example, when the Muslims took over the land of Egypt from the Byzantine Romans, it actually reduced the tax that people paid by 90%. So, you know, it's not that they were, you know, extorted like a racket or it's like some kind of mafia or anything like that. And just to sort of end with, you know, something that the Prophet, peace be upon him, the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, said, whoever oppresses a non-Muslim, a dhimmi, the word was mentioned before, or imposes upon him more than he can afford and humiliates him or takes anything from him without his consent, I will challenge him on the day of judgment. This is the status that was given to minorities.
Yes. Tom's going to come back on that, and then we're going to have a question, and then
I think this is a whitewashing of what happened. The institution, the jizya was clearly lifted from Roman taxation policy towards the Jews. There was a reason that Jews did not serve in the military. They were banned from serving in the military.
You know what? I don't want to spend too long.
But let me just. I will read from one Muslim jurist. According to Ibn Abbas, the dhimmi is struck on the neck with the hand when the tribute is collected from him. That does not sound to me tremendously progressive.
Okay, so that's back then. We've got a question from the audience. Gentleman with the yellow tie. Can we have the Puritanism? Okay.
Forgive me if this is a bit of a throwing a spanner in the works, but in terms of coming to terms with modernity, my question is, if the Mahdi or the Qayyim had already appeared about 170 years ago in southern Persia, how would that affect today's theme?
I'm not sure we want to go into the Mahdi. Abdullah, can you bring it back up to the modern time? I mean, let's talk about...
Well, I would just really wanted to have a response to what was just said. If you actually look at the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam's treatment of dhimmis, there was no striking on the back of the neck. There was no humiliation. In fact, there was one Christian tribe in Syria who said that we don't want to pay jizya, but we will send our armed men to fight as part of the Muslim army. And then jizya was exempted from them because they joined the Muslims, who were all Muslims, all considered to be reservists in the army. So what you're saying is not really the whole story. And the argument you're putting forth for the Pact of Omar too is actually, historians actually are divided on the matter, because the original Pact of Omar was actually the most permissive of Christians. Didn't say that they had to have all these impositions upon them or humiliations upon them. There's a much later recension which came at a much different time during wars between with the Byzantine Empire,
okay, panel,
which
gonna,
led
I'm,
to those things. So we have to go back to the original.
This. No. I'm really sorry. Forgive me.
I just think this goes right to the heart of the debate.
In what way, Tom?
The fact that Abdullah needs to claim that the jizya is in synchronicity with Western notions of human rights demonstrates the degree to which Islam has been... That is clearly what you are saying. It is evident that the function of the jizya in pre-18th century Islamic world was to subordinate the Jews and Christians. The fact that you are unwilling to accept that demonstrates the degree to which you want to accept that Islam is compatible with Western notions of universal human rights.
Whoa. Abdullah, please. I'm only not giving you this moment just because I think the audience deserves for us to be talking about the 21st century, and they may, you know, to be continually unpicking a piece of history is not fair on them. Okay, so, yes, a gentleman with his hand up. Oh, did he? Yes, sir.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity to raise the question. Hissi Ali has already proposed 5 amendments in terms of reforming Islam. And I'd like to remind the panel that they are already prescribed. Good doctor already hit on one. The fifth one was ridding the idea of jihad. And she also labels, in terms of an amendment, a key amendment would be changing the attitude towards the Hadith in the Quran in the consideration is clearly made by human hands. The second one is a consideration and value of life after death, to invert that, to consider and to extol more life before death. The third one was to diminish and to remove Sharia law as a demand for Muslim citizens who don't live in a Sharia law society. And the other one was the principle of diminishing or removing that which is commanded to be right and forbidding which is wrong. So again, the fifth one was ridding the idea of jihad. Those are the 5 principles that she's proposed, and I'd like to propose that the panel, and as the chairwoman has actually said, these are contemporaneous issues for reforming Islam. Would the panel like to address, as the good doctor has already started, any one of those 5?
Thank you very much for your question, sir.
A few points there. I mean, I think Ayaan Hirsi Ali's project is, in her own words, is she would like a mass exodus of people, of Muslims from Islam. That is actually her agenda. But what she'll settle for, if there isn't a mass exodus, is some kind of gut and filleting Islam, and saying that there are some problematic ideas like the ones you, alleged problematic ideas like the ones you raised, jihad. These need to be, if we change them, then we have a palatable Islam. Now that is the question, and that is the debate tonight. That is, does Islam need to be gut and filleted in the way Ayaan Hirsi Ali is proposing? And I submit to you that it doesn't. And there are at least 2 arguments I can give, and I know we haven't got time, but I want to just state the arguments, and then hopefully I can unpack it later on. One reason why Islam stays modern, doesn't have to conform to modernity, Islam doesn't have to fit a modality, a way things are, i.e. the status quo. Islam doesn't have to fit that. It only has to be updated. It only has to be modern. Now, how does Islam remain modern? Here are 2 arguments. The argument from human fulfillment. What that means, just very quickly, I'm going to give you 2 syllogisms. Whatever addresses human needs is thoroughly modern. Islamic law or Islam comprehensively addresses human needs. How? Because it addresses personal social realities, behavioural psychological realities, economic realities, political legal realities, etc., etc. Therefore, Islam is thoroughly modern. The second argument, you could call it the argument from extendability or internal adaptability. The argument goes something like this. whatever system has internal mechanisms to deal with adaptability and extendability doesn't need reforming. Islam has sufficient internal mechanisms to enable it to adapt and to extend for all times. Therefore, Islam does not need reforming. Now, what are these internal mechanisms that allow Islam to be extendable for all ages? The Quran and the Hadith, I know some of the panelists don't accept Hadith, but those that are authentic, they enable countless rulings to be derived from a finite set of data. I.e., the language and the dynamism of these references allow Muslims to be able to deduce many, 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 many laws for all times. Another way that Islam remains adaptable and extendable in every age is the fact that Islam, you know, doesn't care where technology or industry comes from. You know, it could come from the east, the west, the north, or the south. As long as it's technology that benefits human beings, it's not linked to a civilization, so Islam doesn't mind where technology comes from. So that's not a hindrance. A third matter that allows Islam to be extendable for all times is this idea of ijtihad. Now, ijtihad is not critical thinking. Ijtihad is not anyone's own interpretive endeavor. Ijtihad is going to the Islamic references, going to the Islamic sources, and extracting a solution for a new issue. So these are two arguments to show how Islam remains fresh and modern. Anyone who's qualified to do ijtihad, the door is fully open for you, male or female. Ghazali was against ijtihad. He did ijtihad.
No, he said he was closed.
One second, I just want to clarify for the non-Muslims in the audience that what we seem to be talking about here is that the gates of understanding and interpretation are already there, so nothing needs to be changed. It needs to be understood in a modern context.
No, and some jurists did. They did state that we've got a total body of law. What possible new scenarios could emerge that Islamic law or the jurists haven't already addressed?
Good, I'm going to
some
stop you there.
Some jurists closed the door,
question.
But in reality it wasn't closed.
Thank you, sir. Yes? And I'd quite like us all to think about that in the audience, please. Are there any moments or... any incidences... Well, that Islam is unable to address in a modern context. Maybe somebody might like to ask that.
On the question of modernity and reformation, isn't it more a case of does Islam need to avoid stagnation? So, for example, in Surah Al-Baqarah, chapter 2, verse 282, it talks about how get a man as a witness, but if you can't, then use two women, so one may remind the other if she errs. Now, in modern times, I can't really see how that's an issue because most people in society can read and write. They can recognise their own signature on a piece of paper. There's nothing actually for them to remember. Mm. Now, my question is, the four main schools of jurisprudence, the founders, there's Maliki, Shafi, Hanbali, Hanifi, all say that if someone openly admits that they no longer are a Muslim, they should be killed. Now, in a modern caliphate, would that be an acceptable position? Has that position already been reformed, or does Islam need reforming?
Okay, thank you very much. Wait, I'm just going to summarise that before you come back. Sorry, sir. I think we want to keep it here rather than in the UK. I just want these last few questions to remain about life in the UK. Rather than in a fantasy caliphate, if that's okay with everybody. Saf, do you want to talk about that?
Islam did stagnate when we closed when ijtihad was removed, because ijtihad is one way in keeping Islam fresh. As I mentioned in my argument, it's one of the tools by which Islam always remains fresh. But this idea that certain parts of Islam that may not be palatable to sort of a liberal outlook. Needs to be changed in order for Islam to be reformed. Well, Islam in its golden age still had these precepts and these ideas of, related to apostasy and some of the allegedly problematic stuff that was raised by the panelists. Yet, You know, Islam had its golden age. So what we can see from that is that being advanced is not premised on removing or changing these precepts and these ideas. Because if it was the case, then in order for us to progress again, you know, what we're saying is that if in order for us to progress, we have to remove these issues related to apostasy, related to dhimmi rights and so on. Whereas Islam had its golden age, even when it was still upholding these precepts and these ideas. So the two don't go together.
I mean, the question that was asked, I think, basically boils down to the fact, should Muslims be free to apostatize without penalty? What is, you know, and I'd be interested to know what the opinion of the Muslims on this panel was on that. Should Muslims be free to apostatize without suffering?
Undoubtedly, without any ifs and buts, because the Quran allows you to disagree. There is no compulsion in religion. And if God had willed, he would have made all people believe. So yes, I have a right to tonight, okay, if so I wish, so to leave Islam and nothing should happen to me. That is my inalienable human right. Okay. That is a Quranic right.
Thank you, Dr. Todd. So I think actually putting it in the context about the reformation of Islam, if we live in living in Britain, do the rules about apostasy apply and do they need changing so that people can become secular liberalists or live a life... Abdullah, please.
That the old chestnut of apostasy always brought up, and I've always said the same thing, and I'll say it again, which is there's no law that creates an inquisition court in a caliphate or in the UK that will check everyone's beliefs and see if they've left Islam or not. All right. However, the laws that do exist are not really translated as apostasy. Irtidad, to renege or being a renegade, basically, is a law against sedition and treason. Not against just someone who just changes their mind in their own head, and that's it. And no one's going to basically investigate or find out who's left or what have you. So that's the case. There's another point that I think needs to be mentioned is the West experienced 600 years of technological progression before the first secular liberal democracy, from the 12th century up until, let's say, the 18th century, when they were colonizing our lands. Women didn't have the right to own property after marriage. So when the West was coming to civilize us, in the West, women didn't have the right to own property. There were certainly no LGBT rights. There's a whole, but basically, the West you see today is really the creation about 20, 30, maybe 50 years ago, very recent. But Western superiority in technology has nothing to do. No. We're talking about progression. We're talking about progression. Progression has nothing, no link to. These particular laws. Just look at China. China's not really a secular liberal state either.
Hang on, do bring it back.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about apostasy. Is it relevant in the United Kingdom to have these tracked?
There's no law that can be translated into English as apostasy laws in Islam. That's what my point.
No, you had a question. I don't think he is. I have asked him twice. I will take another question. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, it is a very interesting discussion we're having. But I think on the panel, I can see there's no honest understanding of secularism, and there's no honest understanding of what's happening to Muslims around the world. I agree with Theo that probably most Muslims, when they see secularism, they see it as a threat. I know many secular humanists who would like to see Muslims treated as an equal part of the society. That is not a dominant view in the West at the moment. The dominant view of secularism is that it is like the state religion, which should be imposed on anyone.
Question, please, and if question for the panel.
We've do the panel about. Agree with me?
Well done.
Me that in modern Britain,
right.
A Muslim that is born here and over his life or her life looks at various ways of life and chooses Islam voluntarily and embraces it wholeheartedly, can expect to be treated as a second-class citizen with a parallel system of justice, where if you commit a crime, you are prosecuted under one set of laws that non-Muslims are not. When you express your religion in school, you are treated as an extremist, and there is a whole government policy funded with tens of millions of pounds to try and force Muslims not to express their Islam.
I think we take your point. Thank you very much. Theo.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult question that we're trying to address tonight. It's a very difficult question. It's a very important question. I'm afraid to say it's been evaded pretty much so far, because a lot of people understandably prefer to talk about grievances, to say, what about these things the West's done wrong? That's another discussion, I'd say. It's an important discussion. I'm not saying you shouldn't be allowed to discuss that stuff, but I'm saying it's getting in the way of this question. We were invited to talk about this question. Does Islam need a reformation? A very, very difficult question for a lot of people here tonight, for anybody. One perspective we haven't really talked about is when Muslims live in a majority non-Muslim country, i.e. here, for example, things are a bit different from traditional Islam, where it's assumed that the nation is Muslim. The vast majority, or totally, it's a Muslim nation. It's a different ballgame, in a sense, when Muslims are in a non-Muslim country, isn't it? And in a sense, all Muslims in Britain are sort of reformed. They are sort of accepting of the nation. In as far as they live here and don't emigrate, they are accepting that there is something valid about our, let's call it, secular humanist order. If they thought it was absolutely wrong, they'd be off to Syria or somewhere else, Saudi Arabia if you like, or Iran, or you name the country, Indonesia, whatever. They'd be off to a country which was majority Muslim. So by living here, you are accepting that there is validity in this order. And there's a difficult tension there, I'm hearing from you, but that's in a sense the reality.
Good summary. Thank you, Theo. I take your point. Can I come over? I'm going to come to Zara. So the fact that that Muslims are here in numbers, they're staying here, they're not automatically going to Saudi Arabia or Syria, as people tell me on Twitter I should do because I wear a headscarf. Does it, though, mean, seriously, an automatic acceptance that there's good here and therefore we are naturally adapting?
Well,
our faith.
Inherent in this statement that, you know, if you disagreed with the system, you wouldn't be here, is a command that you have to agree with the system in order to live here. Which is like, it is dictating conformance to a structure where you are not allowed to have differences of opinion. You're not allowed to have criticism of what is the governing of the prevalent ideology.
The basic ethos of the nation. Do you think it should be overturned and something else?
No, I didn't say the basic ethos. But you've said in your statement basically that if you disagreed, you wouldn't be here. But that's saying you're not allowed to disagree if you live here. It is exactly the same as saying
so you
that.
Are allowed to
and
disagree.
This is one of the problems with how secular liberalism manages minorities by demanding them to conform to something rather than having, you know, in Islam, Muslims are commanded to be good citizens of wherever you're living, either improve it or just leave it the same. It doesn't ask that you do anything more or less than that. So this is something that, you know, Muslims can live anywhere. You can be a good citizen anywhere. This is not something that, you know, you have to leave and go off somewhere. And where would we go, by the way? I was born here. Many of the young Muslims here were born here. I mean, I think that there is a shocking trajectory to what you've just said.
Yeah, you're demonising what I said. I didn't say anyone should go anywhere. So you're being a bit naughty.
You said that if you don't go, you're saying that if you disagreed, you wouldn't be here, which has the same implication.
By being here, to some extent, you're accepting where you are.
I mean, to be fair,
well, you can accept where you are without wanting to, you don't have to overthrow a system if you disagree with it. You can be somewhere that you disagree.
Okay, very nice. Time for another question. Middle aside, yes.
Hi, this question is for Theo and the other panelists as well. Just now Theo mentioned that the Christian Reformation started off with a minority of Christians. Seems that it was an inherently Christian thing. So the question is, if Islam needs a reformation, who gets to decide? Who is the arbiter between deciding whether Islam needs a reformation or not? How do you decide? Is it a majority of Muslims, like what you said, in the realm of ideas, the best arguments eventually win because the majority of Christians have accepted it. So if the majority of Muslims do not accept that we need a reformation, will you then accept that Islam doesn't need a reformation?
Okay, good. So I'm going to pass that over to Tom.
Okay, well, this question, it reflects the can of worms that happens when you, as a person of faith, decide that you need a reformation and you assume that it is self-evident what primal Christianity or primal Islam should be. That is what Luther assumed. He assumed that if you got rid of the cladding of Catholic tradition, then the manifest evidence of what original primal Christianity was would shine forth. It did not, because there was no definitive answer to that. And so within a few years, you started getting Calvin and Anabaptists and all kinds of people. The same thing is clearly happening with Islam now. So you have ISIS shot through with totalitarian notions. In Denmark and in Tajis mosques, you have women leading prayers. Both cast themselves as responses to this question of what was primal Islam? What did Muhammad do? What does God want? There is no definitive answer. And that's part of the dislocating sense of excitement and also alarming process of what I think is happening in Islam at the moment, why it is so exciting to study, but also why it's so terrifying and in many, many cases violent, because there is no certain answer to that.
Wait. I'm going to go to Abdullah. Abdullah, is ISIS a reformation movement or an aberration? And is Islam this terrifying vision that Tom has?
Well,
ISIS, a reforming movement,
They're neither. They just carry on the practices of their father, Saddam Hussein, and every other dictator in the region. Everyone uses religious discourse to rubber stamp anything they want to do in the Middle East. Everyone does it. Saddam Hussein put Allah on the flag, said he was a Sayyid. He used swords of the Quran to gas Kurds. And his children are doing, who started out being secular, I might add, are now doing it as well. And it's no surprise that when, you know, Gaddafi got fired from his role of suppressing a holistic Islam, his followers rebelled, and now they're joining a new ISIS branch in Libya. And it's no coincidence. So in the Middle East, basically, all these rulers, all their followers and so on and so forth, they're pragmatists, they believe in ends justifies the means, and Islam is held hostage by them and only relegated to a rubber stamp of whatever justification that they want. And there has no links. And just to give you a very small example of how it doesn't fit with Islam, with the most fundamental texts and understandings of Islam. So, for example, the killing of Alan Henning, which under Islamic law would be a protected person, musta'min, beating and torturing prisoners of war. Show me which opinion in Islam throughout classical period or any period has said that you can do that in Islam. Executing prisoners of war is a weak opinion, but executing people who convert to Islam who are prisoners of war is absolutely prohibited. Enslaving and raping civilians is absolutely prohibited, especially people who are from the peoples of the former, the Dhimma, like the Yazidis and Christians and others. Burning.
Dhimma.
Sorry?
Yazidis.
They've lived 1,300 years under three different caliphate dynasties. You're saying that they only, they're Dhimmis. They've never been Dhimmis. Come on. Yazidis haven't been.
The people of the book.
But take his point, they have lived to survive to this point.
Yes, the Islamic Empire had to adjust to the fact that there were people other than Jews, Christians, and Sabaeans.
The Zoroastrians were not people of the book, yet they were given Dhimmi status.
Exactly. And Yazidis, the Quran was insufficient to organise the Islamic Empire.
I think we've got a good point here. Hang on a second. People who are not in the Quran as protected status, people have managed to live under Islamic rule for more than 1,000 years. That means that there was an adjustment.
We have hadith from the Prophet Muhammad that said that treat the Zoroastrians as you would treat the people of the book, which expanded that notion to everybody, basically, including Hindus.
Just to continue. The Arabs had conquered
Persia. Actually, no, because we have quite a lot of discourse regarding Zoroastrians from different hadiths by the Prophet Muhammad.
Yes, but when did Islam originate?
Islam didn't pop out from aliens introducing 1,400 years ago or something
like this,
right?
It emerged in the course of 8th century history.
Okay, I mean, I know you like your flights of fantasy. in terms of the origins of Islam. And maybe we can look forward to a book said Salahuddin Vampire Hunter, The New Untold Story. But
please don't be responding
to my argument. Okay. Personal abuse.
I said
Abdullah is on a Abdullah, you are on a warning.
Okay, no,
I'm not sure he's going to write about vampire slayers.
No, I make no comment about. I'm only making comment about your arguments. I don't make comment about yourself. Okay.
Vampire writer, which of course I was at one point, but I don't think you meant it as a compliment.
Okay, Tom, I have the chair has addressed that. We're going to move on. You have one point.
For example, one very pernicious point was ISIS burnt one of their prisoners alive, which, as every Muslim knows, and there's no difference of opinion on the matter, you can't burn anyone because that's meant to be the punishment reserved for God, and there's many hadith that attest to that. So ISIS don't care about hadith. They call themselves an Islamic State before they even controlled one town. Remember, they've been there for a couple of years in Iraq since 2010 or something like this. They don't care about what Islam says. All they care about is power and recreating some kind of Ba'athist regime
Thank
or
you.
Something like
I'm
this after the fall of Saddam Hussein.
I mean, this idea that ISIS doesn't reflect Islam, I'm sorry to tell you guys, they do. That's what they say. For example, in the issue of jihad, it's exactly the same as the Saudis and the Wahhabis and Salafis. The issue with women, discrimination, subjugation, exactly the same as Saudis, Wahhabis, and so forth. And the issue of interfaith relations, not to have any dealings with them. And the list goes on and on and on. We have to be honest and say these people are doing this stuff in the name of a perverted, toxic Islam derived from the terrible trio, the hadith, the sharia, and the fatwas. Why can't we say that and admit that?
Okay,
Saudi Arabia.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay.
And Iran.
And we, the British and the Americans, just stop supporting them.
Thank you.
And Iran?
Of course, them too.
Yeah.
The whole lot.
So which?
We have to be equal.
Which Muslim countries are okay?
Sorry?
Which Muslim countries are okay?
Maybe Malaysia? Maybe
okay,
the,
stop.
Morocco?
Dr. Taj, thank you. We take your point. That's very interesting. We did ask about, is ISIS a reformation movement or not? You've had the discussion on ISIS. I really want to spend the last few moments in the United Kingdom. So only questions about Muslims and Islam in the United Kingdom, please. The front here.
I'll apologize first because this isn't exactly about the United Kingdom, but it's about Europe. So as Muslims spread across the world, surely localization of Islam is inevitable. So take, for example, Muslims in Sweden. When we take a basic practice of fasting, which pretty much every Muslim does during Ramzan. So this year, fasting will happen during the summer when the sun never sets in the north of Sweden. So surely Muslims in that part of the world will be adapting that practice for where they live in. It's not like they're not going to eat for a whole month, right? So they will be adapting to that part of the world. So if they can adapt fasting, why can't they adapt certain other practices? That's
okay.
The question.
It's a good question. So, Zara, do you want to?
I don't know if Seth wants to expand on that, but I would just say that my understanding is fasting started out in the month of Ramadan, which was the hottest month originally. So it's not really an adaptation.
But that's not Islam adapting, really, is it? But here the Jews have addressed extremities. The Jews have. If you look at the manuals of Islamic law, you would see there are a plethora of opinions as to what to do then in these particular extremities. So you can take the neighbouring time or the neighbouring region. If you can't fast, you don't fast. I mean, that's
just expand this point. Look,
but your question
Muslims,
about adaptability, of that,
about
that's
adaptability.
What I wanted to unpack.
And,
what did you mean about
living in Europe?
So when we said about British Islam, when we were talking about British Islam earlier or French Islam, that's what I was trying to say. So if you can adapt a very fundamental practice of Islam, which is fasting, depending on where you live in, why can't you localize other practices as well?
Can I just ask what else? Well, one minute, I will come back to you. One second. What do you want to see adapted then? Do you have a list of things that
I don't. Okay. It's just when we made a point earlier about localization of Islam and saying British Islam.
Let's take a couple
Islam.
More questions. Thank you very much. Okay, question here on the left. And then yes, gentleman in the blue hat. Sorry, your arm's been up a long time.
Hi there. My question is to Tom, and it's essentially because how much do you think that the problems we're discussing about Islam in the UK is because that Islam claims a monopoly on truth. That combined with the fact that it has doctrines born from 7th century Arabia provides a situation where they loggerheads with sort of Western civilization. Because you know, I'm a Hindu, for example, and as a Hindu, you believe that God is one, but he's revealed in many, many different ways, in many different traditions. But this exclusivist truth claim, I think, is what's contributing to this idea of, you know, apostasy, which was neatly dodged, and this idea of the jizya as well. So how much do you think it's something to do with that?
I think the reason that traditionally the House of Islam and Christendom have the relations have been so combustible is that both of them, to a degree unique among civilizations, claim a universalism for their values and their ideals. Islam claims to be the ultimate revelation, claims an absolute truth. It has been given to Muhammad by God, and the power that is invested in that is of a literally divine order. And therefore, ultimately, I would imagine that for most Muslims, maybe even today, but certainly in the classical period, the conviction that it is for the good of the entire world to submit to Islam is absolutely normative. Christians, of course, had the same conviction. And although Christians today in the West are probably less self-confident about that, I think that the belief that European values, Western values, are universal in their application, similarly remain as strong. So that, I think, is why there is a unique tension between mainstream Western society and Muslims more than, say, Hindus or Sikhs or even Jews. I kind of agree with Abdullah on this, that there is an incredible tension between the claims of Western liberalism, which essentially claims for itself the right to contain within itself every other belief system, including Islam. So in a sense, the jizya that Muslims have to pay to live within a secular democracy is to accept the primacy of those Western secular liberal values over that of Islam. Then they are able, if they accept that, then they are allowed to practice Islam and say what they like.
So assimilation then, not multiculturalism?
I don't think it's necessarily assimilation. I think, but just as Christians, if they were to live in the Ottoman Empire, the Abbasid Empire, whatever.
Too.
Yes, but yeah, of course. I mean, that's a different issue. But just as Christians in the Abbasid Empire or the Ottoman Empire, you know, they were allowed to practice their religion. But if they started getting uppity, if they started if they started offending the laws of the Ottoman state, then they could expect the full force of Ottoman law to come down on them. So likewise, Muslims are perfectly allowed to say what they want, to believe what they want, to do what they want, until such time as it starts to infringe the laws of the British state.
That's a great point to go to the audience with. Thank you, Tom. That was brilliantly summarised, I think, of the situation. No, Abdullah? I mean, in other words, Muslims are allowed to be in these secular liberal states as long as they don't transcend the liberal boundaries, which is illiberal, or is it?
Well, it depends what the laws are. I mean, every country says, sure, you can live here and do what you want as long as you don't cross over those laws. But the question is, what are those laws? And in Britain recently, the discourse has become very worryingly about a particular set of British values as defined by the ruling party, which now, and Muslims are now categorized into extreme and non-extreme.
Well, so oppressive?
The idea of British values and the declaration.
How does that oppress you?
Okay, I'll give you one example. So David Cameron said, in essence, that everyone who believed in the idea of or the Islamic concept of caliphate is an extremist. And then he later on said that we should have a war against, we are at war with those who believe in extremism. So this is now declaring Muslims to be the modern-day heretics, and that we shouldn't somehow have to be dealt with in some manner through fair means or foul, including but not limited to harassment from security services, a whole prevent agenda, banning of certain Muslim speakers coming into the country or speaking at universities, control orders, charity commission enforcement powers, disproportionately affecting.
You're playing the victim.
Okay, I'm just raising
issues. You're playing the victim.
Are these not realities, though?
Whoa.
Are these not realities?
I take your point, and I also take the point that Are we now talking about Muslims being forced to change rather than Islam itself being questioned as a reformation in the modern age? Maybe we've gone slightly off topic, but both of you had valid points. I'm going to come back to you in a second. There was a gentleman in a blue hat. He's been so patient, please.
Actually, the talk about reformation going on there, nobody mentioning that which part of Islam they want to reform. I say Islam says that justice should prevail all the time. It does not allow that if citizen of the country, you can't get the justice. If you are not citizen of the country, you can end up in Guantanamo Bay. These are the things Islam doesn't allow. The justice all the time. Equality all the time. Somebody mentioned about the women, the witnesses. It's not true. Only one place mentioned, the Brahman mentioned, the person who was traveling going on there. Other places mentioned Quran that men and women equal witness. In the same way mentioned, people be mentioning here, jihad all the time. Jihad actually Arabic word, which means struggle. I don't know what people have got difficulty to use that word, struggle. It's struggle against the evil. Who can deny that it should not be like that? Islam does not allow that to kill anyone, innocent person.
Politely, is there a question?
Another thing, Islam says that equal rights to everybody. Even if you are not Muslim, you can live by your own laws.
Okay, thank you very much for that point. Middle center. We've only got time for two or three more questions, and then we're going to have a little summary. So I'll take two more questions only.
There's been a lot of obscuring and obscurantism on the part of particularly Abdullah Al-Andalusi when it comes to the matter of apostasy. And I think I should do everyone here a favor by elucidating some of the Islamic proofs for said thing. Because you said a few challenges, didn't you? You said bring an example of, for example, torture. And so I'll do that for you. For example, the Prophet verbatim said, "Man badala dinahu faqtuluh." Those are words particularly attributed to him. There are other examples as well. In terms of the
why are you bringing these examples? What's
because for some reason there's been a lot of talk and no actual substance. So I'm here to introduce
give us some
substance
with a good question. And
okay, yeah, sure. Okay, so for example, in terms of the jizya, again, there was no elaboration on the actual ideas of the jizya. The particular Treaty of Omar that Tom Holland mentioned.
But hang on, there's another question, it's a comment. We've moved on from
Please
that.
Listen.
We're trying to keep it relevant to here
yes.
and now. That's why.
Yes, but
that's
question,
why the panel
yes,
has moved
you
on.
See, yes, but you see the question with the
one
Reformation
more chance.
Doesn't really make sense.
One more chance for a good question.
I see. There isn't really a question. I just wanted to elucidate the fact.
Okay, thank you. Next. Yes, back. Thank you. Yes. I think you have Jeff Glasses back here. Thank you.
I think the whole discussion has been framed in terms of Muslims in this country have certain values, and they're at odds with the values around them. And I speak to Christians and Catholics every day, and they too feel as though the secularist imposition on their lives. So it's not just about Muslims thinking that we have certain values and that this whole British values discourse is impinging upon their our lives. It's actually other people, Christians and Catholics and others in the society, who feel as though the society around them is redefining what it means to be British.
Okay, thank you. I'm actually going to stop questions there in order that we get 30 seconds. It doesn't make any sense, Stephen, leaving my mouth saying 30 seconds. But can you please just give us a tiny summary of your standpoint now at the end to do with British values and Muslims fitting in and Islam being a system that works in the West? And I will begin with Saf.
So what do you want to answer all those points in 30 seconds?
Do you want to summarise where you are now, in terms of a parting thought?
I think, you know, in terms of British Islam, we need to be very, very cautious. Perhaps the cautionary position would be to take a disassociative stance from the idea of British being attached to Islam, especially because it's vague, but more so because it's couched in ideational, axiological terms, i.e. to do with concepts and values. In other words, British Islam, as I see it, is a way of Muslims being Muslims in this country, not determined from their own references and their own sources, but top-down from politicians. So I think a disassociative stance from British Islam, I know some people appropriate it in a meaningful way, but I think looking at it in a more nuanced way it's something that's been, you know, hatched by politicians and incubated in Downing Street. But just on the point of reformation, there's lots of things I think we didn't get a chance to unpack. But, you know, especially concepts like tajdeed and renewal, ideas like islah, which is not reformation, actually, which is translated as reformation, but it's not. But it's bringing something back to its original pristine and sound state. That would have been good to unpack, because that would have been a good parameter in which to have the discussion.
Okay, and thank you for that parting thought. Parting thought, Theo?
I think I'd say that this sort of discussion is a sign of the reformation of Islam. I think people here, it's happening. Just the fact of us discussing, taking for granted human rights, the rights of women, and so on and so on, it's happening in these very discussions. It's difficult, it's awkward, there's a tension between the tradition and now, but the fact that we're having this discussion, that's my parting shot. It's a good sign.
And Sarah?
I'll be honest, I'm not really interested in a British version of Islam, because Islam naturally, in all the ways that it doesn't really theologically matter, adapts to whichever culture it is in, with the theology generally remaining the same. And I'm particularly not interested in being force-fed any set of values, be they British values, American values, that I don't have a say in what those values actually mean. I'm just expected to sort of accept what someone else is telling me what they mean. With regards to reformation itself, I just want to leave a very simple message, and I think it was mentioned very early on in the discussion, and that is, in the Muslim world, it's in need of revival. It's not in need of reformation. The Muslim world is an example of what happens when you try to change Islam and mix it with secular liberal values. Pakistan, for example, if you want to see whether it's a good idea to reform it in that way, just look to the Muslim world today. The Muslim world needs to revert to its classical understanding. And Muslims who are not in the Muslim world, as individuals, as all members of society, need to consciously be, you know, aware of what they're doing and just generally, reform themselves. But it's nothing to do with their religion.
Dr. Parting thought.
Yeah, I think it's important that we become self-critical and introspective. And I think I'm for a British Islam, not the MI5 variety. And I'm thinking about Islam that is Quran-centric, not paying the lip service or heeding the hadith, the sharia, and the fatwa, all man-made stuff. And I expect this Islam, British Islam, to be gender equal. I expect it to be non-sectarian. I expect it to be intercultural, not multicultural. And I expect it to be independent. We need to cut the umbilical cord that ties us to Saudi Arabia, to the Wahhabis, the Salafis, and all the other extremists there. We want Islam that's open, that's liberal, that's inclusive, that's pluralistic, that belongs here and now.
Thank you very much. Tom?
I think that we live, through the past 50 years, through an incredibly interesting period of British history. On the one hand, we have gone through an ethical and moral revolution of a speed and totality, I think, without precedent in our history. You just have to look at the transformation in attitudes, say, to homosexuality, to illustrate that. Simultaneously with that, there has been a recrudescence of debate and interest in religion that I think is sort of almost unprecedented since the 1650s. So, and this imposes a particular burden, I think, on the Muslims of Britain. And I will finish with two quotations. One, a hadith: every innovation is heresy, every heresy is error, and every error leads to hell. The next one is from Al-Ghazali: strange as it may seem, accepted practices of today are the taboos of a day gone by, and the taboos of today are the accepted practices of a day yet to come.
Thank you very much, Tom. And Abdullah.
I don't believe Islam changes depending on where you are on the earth's crust. And I think that truth doesn't change either, depending on which part of the world you're in. I would say that there's a fundamental mistake here. The majority sect of Christianity never actually reformed Catholicism. They successfully resisted it, and they still rail against secular liberalism to this day, our Catholic brothers. So they would probably join us on this panel and argue similar things in some ways. I would say that if you're going to ask to reform Islam, you need to ask what you want to reform it to,
And the reason why we mention secular liberalism today is if you just look at secular liberalism, the wealth inequality that creates 62 people on this planet controlling 40 or 50% of the wealth of this world, according to an Oxfam report, is quite shocking, as well as the simultaneous epidemics of obesity and famines happening at the same time. These are issues that I think Islam should be addressing, including climate change, I might add, that also has been affected by capitalism's overproduction. But what I would just finish off by saying is that laws aren't actually linked to progress. So China, not a secular liberal country, but look, it's now catching up with the US, might surpass it. The West had 600 years of progress without secular liberalism, and Islam could do the same. My final parting shot would be that the Muslim world does have a problem, a very big problem. But the problem is that Muslims need to be reformed, but Islam only needs to be revived. And that's it.
Thank you. Thank you. You've been an amazing audience. You've been full of great questions. You've been enthusiastic. You've been polite. And to the panel, they've all come a long way. They've worked hard on preparing their argumentation and their thoughts. Thanks very much to all of you. Thanks very much to each of you. And I can't get the thought of Salahuddin, the Dracula Slayer, out of my mind. If you were to write it, I'd read it. We didn't mean to be rude. Any mistakes we've made, forgive us. And I hope you take away some little knowledge and some more thoughts. Thank you very much.